Well, thanks very much, David, and my apologies for being almost half an hour late. Such are the vagaries of democracy. I'm not sure what the opposition was trying to achieve by prolonging question time with the suspension of standing orders, but it certainly just wasted everyone's time, and in fact, I think the whole week and the line of questioning has been somewhat perplexing, to say the least. But it is a great delight to be here, and can I recognise Ivan Davidson, Chairman and President of CEDA, and many other business guests who I recognise from the brief time I had at the table looking about the room. It's always an interesting topic to talk about the bilateral economic relationships that Australia holds, and particularly on this occasion in regard to our resources and energy sector, our bilateral relationship with China. China is, of course, the world's greatest growth market, and one which Australia is exceptionally well placed and well suited to tap into. As it grows, so too will our resources and energy boom continue. We have seen our total energy and mineral resource exports expand, bad weather permitting, from $54 billion in 2003-04 to $107 billion in 2006-07. And our mineral resource exports to China alone are worth some $11 billion in 2005-06, or 21% of our total mineral export trade. It's no accident, though, that Australia is reaping the benefits of this boom, and certainly we're blessed with the resources, but then again, so too are many other countries. We are where we are today through a concerted effort to build our relationship with China and the Asian region in general. We have built our credibility as a secure and reliable supplier, and through our many economic reforms, we have enhanced our own international competitiveness. Part of that hard work lies in the APEC framework, and I've recently returned from attending and chairing one of the most critical APEC meetings of the year, the Energy Ministers' Meeting in Darwin. And apart from the weather being exceptionally warm, especially when you've thinned your blood out with 38-degree heat in Darwin to come back to this, the talks themselves were very, very successful, and they reinforced the importance and significance of the two-way relationship we have with a range of countries in APEC, and in particular with China. Thought today I'd talk a little about what Australia can offer beyond our endowment in resources, and particularly in the areas of international competitiveness, our close relationship with China, our reputation, as I've already said, as a secure and reliable supplier, and our leadership in developing and employing practical and realistic measures to minimise the impact that we have on our environment. Our ability to develop our resources in an environmentally sustainable way is now, quite rightly, a very strong focus for Australia. When the Prime Minister addressed CEDA last year, he spoke of the potential for Australia to become a world energy superpower. I can only say that I agree with him wholeheartedly. And but for that, the economic potential of Australia to be fully realised, we need to act responsibly, though, to ensure that the environment that we live in has the footprint minimised from our expansion of energy and resources. Contrary to the Labor rhetoric, the government has not just entered into the debate on the environment and how to combat climate change. In fact, the Howard government started acting on this issue long before the debate was even mainstream. What is often overlooked is that while those who look for these soapbox opportunities to criticise our government and mix with their metaphors a range of breathtaking inaccuracies and generalisations, we have in fact as a government taken action very early in our term of government and put in place a range of realistic and practical solutions to the challenge we face. Our first action was in 1996, when Australia established the first dedicated office for greenhouse management in the world, the groundbreaking Australian Greenhouse Office. In 2001, we set the world's first mandatory renewable energy target, the MRED as it is known, to increase the deployment of renewable energy, particularly in our electricity sector. This has led to great increases in renewable energy development and use in Australia, and in the case of wind, an 8,000% increase as a result of the MRED. As mentioned in the introduction, in June 2004, our government released its energy white paper, outlining many key initiatives to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, totalling over $700 million, and including the $500 million Low Emission Technology Demonstration Fund. And as a result of these initiatives, we lead the world in the development of clean coal and carbon capture and storage. In a world first, Australia is also establishing an international legal framework to allow the storage of carbon dioxide under the seabed, a critical step in promoting widespread uptake of this important technology. Late last year, the Prime Minister established a joint government business task group on emissions trading. This task group examined what form an emissions trading scheme might take, both in Australia and globally, as part of a broader climate change challenge. 10 days ago, the Prime Minister announced Australia would move towards a cap-and-trade domestic emissions trading system beginning no later than 2012. This scheme will be national in scope and meticulous and comprehensive in detail. It will be designed to take account of global developments and, importantly, to preserve the competitiveness of our trade-exposed, energy-intensive industries. Our government's approach is one based on practical, realistic solutions, something that is evident in a similar way by our engagement with other countries, particularly China. We're taking a leadership role in the Asia-Pacific Partnership on Clean Development and Climate, or AP6 as it's otherwise known, to deliver practical technology solutions to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The AP6 initiative is crucial given that it includes India, China, Japan, South Korea, the US and Australia. And it's the first time that the US, India and China have worked together on this issue. Collectively, these countries in the AP6 account for 47.8% of the world's emissions as of the year 2000. And it should be remembered in that total that Australia accounted for just 1.5%. China, whose emissions were 14.7% of the world's emissions in 2000, is expected to see its emissions increase to 22.9% by 2050, overtaking the US as the biggest emitter of greenhouse gas. By comparison, during this period, Australia's emissions are expected to shrink to less than 1% of the world's emissions by 2050. The conundrum for countries like China and India, though, is how to grow their economies while keeping their emissions in check. Initiatives such as AP6, which aim to help China develop without massive increases in emissions, will be key to the world's efforts of combating climate change and greenhouse gas emissions. Our $100 million investment in the AP6 is helping to focus efforts in government and industry to promote technology transfer and foster positive environmental outcomes. The active involvement of Australian industry in identifying ways in which AP6 outcomes can be implemented, particularly through projects in China and India, has been very encouraging. In recognition that international collaboration is critical to the success of clean coal technology, the Prime Minister and Premier Wen from China announced the establishment of the Australia-China Joint Coordination Group on Clean Coal Technology earlier this year. This JCG was established to provide guidance to a range of cooperative clean coal activities and to identify opportunities for closer collaboration with China. Currently, it is focused on joint projects in the area of coal gasification, carbon capture and storage, post-combustion capture and education and training. All of these and other initiatives are and will have an impact on our resources and energy trade. I said earlier that China looks to Australia as a reliable source of quality energy and resources. Can I go into some detail on that topic? As I've said, China is the largest market for Australia's export of mineral commodities. Just as Japan drove the investment boom in Australia in the 60s, China is now driving the investment boom in Australia today. The fact that China is such a huge market is also a driver of major investment here. Investing in Australian projects is a lot more than securing just the project and putting money into projects in some other parts of the world. We have here in Australia the building and strengthening of the relationship between China and Australia, and a relationship that has led to the establishment of negotiations on a bilateral free trade agreement. As well as supporting free trade in goods and services between Australia and China, the FTA is very much aimed at supporting two-way investment in each other's countries. Chinese investors have easy access to the Australian resource sector through an open and transparent process, and we now hope to open the Chinese resource sector to Australian investors. This will expand future resource opportunities for the value-added exports of mining equipment and services, and Australia will be in a position to better accommodate Chinese exports of mining equipment to meet our own needs. The eighth round of the Australia-China FTA negotiations was held in late March of this year in Beijing. And during these meetings, discussions on trade in services continued and talks began on barriers to trade investment. Now, I don't want to give you the impression that the FTA will happen tomorrow, because quite simply it won't. Such agreements take a long time because of their complexity. But when it happens, it will be a robust arrangement and one which will provide a huge opportunity for Australia here and in China. Two-way investment between Australia and China is substantial and growing. The combined investment from the Greater China region, which includes China, Hong Kong and Taiwan, at the end of 2005 was $36 billion, making the region the fourth largest investor in Australia. Through an agency of my department, Invest Australia, the Australian government has been building on this strong performance. And from April 2004 to the end of February 2007, Invest Australia played an important role in attracting 30 investment projects from China, valued at almost $1 billion, with the potential to create more than 2,000 Australian jobs and generate $639 million per annum in export value. The Australian upstream petroleum industry is also another important element of our trade, given its position as a supplier of secure energy for our region. Given its importance, the Australian government has provided significant funding support to underpin the expansion of upstream industry, including the support for pre-competitive geoscientific data to aid exploration, designated frontier petroleum resource rent tax relief, and non-exclusive seismic policy changes. The opportunities for investment by China in Australia's upstream petroleum industry are substantial. The Australian government's offshore petroleum exploration acreage release is another primary entry point for investment in offshore exploration, and to date, Chinese investment in the Australian upstream industry has resulted in cautious strategic investments, usually through joint venture agreements. The Australian government looks forward to the next stage of that relationship, where Chinese explorers are prepared to submit standalone bids for exploration acreage. If I turn for a moment to LNG, and the Australian upstream industry is changing gear with a push for rapid development of big gas projects to meet the strong demand and growth in LNG markets. Such developments are tempered by labour and skill shortages, which could have a negative impact. But again, this is an area where the government is addressing the issue through increased funding for education and training and through changes in workplace relations. Demand for natural gas in the Asia-Pacific region is growing strongly, and Australia's reputation as a reliable, stable supplier makes our LNG very strongly sought after. While the recent decision by the Californian government, a governor rather, against BHP Billiton's proposed LNG terminal was disappointing, it was, after all, California's call. I note that Governor Schwarzenegger acknowledged California's need for LNG and remain hopeful that Australia can play a role in that supply. But there are many other opportunities for LNG in our region, including alternative points in the North American market, And rather than dwell on the disappointment of California, I can assure you that our marketers of LNG have simply moved on to the next option. Australia is also the first country to supply LNG to China, and the Guangdong LNG contract signed in 2004 was a major milestone in Australia-China political and economic relationships. At the time, this was Australia's largest single export contract ever negotiated, worth some $25 billion. As well as its economic impact, Australian LNG's deal with China will have the effect of reducing China's emissions by 7 million tonnes per year, a significant contribution to the global greenhouse gas abatement. Growing gas demand in China and India, as well as strong demand in traditional markets such as Japan, Korea and Taiwan, will ensure that Australian LNG projects have customers for a long time to come. To meet this, we expect Australia will quadruple our current LNG capacity to 60 million tonnes per annum within the next decade, making us the world's third largest LNG supplier. If we can turn for a moment to coal and the traditional source of energy, coal highlights just how far bilateral trade between Australia and China has developed. Over the last decade, our coal exports to China have grown from near negligible levels to a point where China is a very important customer. In 2006, we exported some 7.8 million tonnes of coal to China, worth almost $600 million. In 2001, for instance, coal exports to China were worth less than $70 million. Over the next 5 years, don't be surprised to see multi-billion dollar deals on coal done between Australia and China. Although China is a major coal producer itself, as well as an exporter, it needs its own coal for its domestic uses, and it needs more than it will produce. In September 2006, the Chinese government abolished a 13% value-added tax refund that was paid for suppliers of export thermal coal, reducing, therefore, their incentive for Chinese producers to target export markets. In November of the same year, the Chinese government also reduced the import duty on thermal coal from 3% to 1%, reducing the landed price of imported coal by about $2 US a tonne. Reflecting these changes to trade policy, China's thermal coal imports are forecast to increase 17% to 35 million tonnes per annum in 2007, while exports will decline by around 3% to 56 million tonnes per annum. Australia, of course, will be well placed to service this market. We are the world's largest coal exporter, and black coal is Australia's largest single export earner, with around $24.5 billion earned in 2005-06. In addition, much of the demand for coal in China is at coastal power stations located many thousands of kilometres from that country's coal mines. Australia is in pole position to supply these power stations both in terms of price and in terms of environmental and economic value of our high-quality clean coal provides. The strong growth in demand for coal in recent years has placed some pressure on our coal infrastructure export terminals. However, the expansion plans for both rail and port infrastructure are well underway and new capacity is coming on stream. And with coal shipping capacity increasing by over 100 million tonnes by the year 2012. We are seeing predictions, however, that capacity will be well and truly needed, with ABARE expecting Australian coal exports to rise 70% to almost 400 million tonnes per year, and at current prices to be worth $40 to $50 billion a year in export income to Australia. There are those who are not, though, supporting the expansion of Australia's coal industry, and between Peter Garrett and Bob Brown taking respective shots at the coal industry, some would be concerned if there was a change of government and those individuals had a major say in the coal industry's future. Let me say that apart from the dire economic consequences of taking such an action, it would have absolutely no impact on a global scale on world emissions, and in fact may increase them. The world, in fact, would be worse off without our cleaner, low-sulphur coals, and our government remains strongly and firmly committed to the growth of Australia's coal industry. The iron ore industry is, of course, another area of huge potential growth, and the growth in Chinese steel production and consumption makes it a key market for Australia. China's steel production in 2006 was 419 million tonnes, which represented nearly just over a third of the world's production. It's forecast to grow by 8% a year to reach 670 million tonnes by the year 2012. Of Australia's iron ore exports in 2006, just over half were destined for China, representing, in fact, about 40% of China's imports. As well as reflecting Australia's abundant supply of high-grade iron ore, this huge trade is indicative of Australia's status as a proven reliable supplier of iron ore in our region. Similar to coal, although China has its own iron ore reserves, China's iron ore production is well below its requirements. Consequently, the Chinese imports of iron ore are projected to grow rapidly, and that growth is to be sourced primarily from Australia. Can I just say in conclusion that the importance of our relationship with China cannot be understated. The strong growth in China's demand for resources over the last 4 to 5 years has placed huge pressures on the international commodity markets. Any spare capacity in the system has been taken up, and whether that be in mines, at ports, in ships, or in schools, or even equipment such as explosives and tyres. We have seen this reflected in Australia, and it's particularly noticeable in terms of coal. We have long queues of ships waiting off our coal ports. Increased prices are providing the investment returns that are needed to support investment in new capacity, and this investment is needed to provide the capacity to fully respond to the current world demand and to meet future growth. For this reason, it is important for customers like China to accept the market imperatives that dictate pricing. These imperatives ensure transparency, which in turn leads to investment, and the end result of that is supply. If customers try to blur that transparency, investment will simply dry up. The simple fact of that is no one wins, and customers, both large and small, must recognise and accept that an operating market is the reality of a supplied future. Incidentally, that's why I've been so critical of the Western Australian state government's efforts to manipulate the gas market in that state by reserving a percentage of gas production for domestic use. It's very hard to reject Chinese pressure to interfere in market operation while state governments attempt such blatant efforts to skew the market in Western Australia for gas. These are issues that come up in my discussions with China, and the strength of the relationship we have with China is evident in the recognition they ultimately give to our market. Our energy and resources trade with China is healthy and promising, but it can only continue to grow, and government and industry need to work together to ensure that it does grow and work together to ensure its future. I'm sure that if we look at the long-term prospects for trade with China, that speech could have been shortened to one word, and that is bright.